Years ago, Laurie Beth Jones wrote a well-known book entitled Jesus CEO. The basic premise of her book is that Jesus was one of history's all-time great leaders, and so if we can identify the principles and patterns that Jesus used in his role of leadership, and then apply those principles and patterns to our own, it will make us much more effective in our leadership roles. That, in a nutshell, is what discipleship is all about. Centuries ago, an even more famous book was written by a mystic named Thomas A. Kempis. The title of his treatise was The Imitation of Christ. Again, the basic premise is we look at the patterns we see in the Gospels in the life of Jesus, and then we strive to incorporate those patterns into our life. So, in that spirit today, I want to invite us to consider, how did Jesus respond to crisis in his life? Because if we can isolate and identify the principles and patterns that Jesus used to respond to crisis in his life, we can then apply those patterns and principles to our life to great effect. So, let's say a prayer and then dive in. God, everywhere we look around us, personally, politically, globally, there is crisis. So much so that there's a part of us that's tempted to want to run away and hide, like the psalmist. There's a part of us that says, oh, if I had the wings of a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. But we know that's not the answer. We know that we are exactly where we are today for a reason, and that we will find purpose and opportunity in where we are. So help us to rise to the occasion. Help us to respond as Jesus would. For it's in his holy name we pray. Amen. As we move through life, we will all experience our situations of crisis. Health crises, relationship crises, financial crises, job and career related crises, emotional crises, faith crises. And then, as if that weren't enough, we have spouses, children, family, and friends in our life who have their own personal crises, which then become our crises because we love them so much. On top of that, we face societal crises. Right now, in America, we're experiencing a crisis of political polarization. Right now, globally, we're experiencing a climate crisis. Right now, globally, we're experiencing a pandemic with the associated economic meltdown. And as if to be the last straw that broke the camel's back, when I got up this morning and turned on the news, I heard a news story, and this may be fake news, but I heard a news story this morning saying that right now, even as we speak, a giant fly is attacking New York City. Don't worry, though. A SWAT team is on it. Get it? Giant fly, SWAT team. Now, I can hear you laughing uproariously at home. You'll never admit it, but I know in the secret of your home you are laughing uproariously. In any event, how did Jesus respond to crisis? Our gospel lesson today, Matthew chapter 14, is an excellent example. The backstory to our gospel passage is that Jesus had just been told that one of his chief spiritual mentors, his cousin, John the Baptist, had been executed by King Herod. You can imagine how that must have impacted Jesus. He just needed to get away and be alone and process his grief. Our gospel passage tells us this, Matthew 14:13. Now, when Jesus heard this, that John the Baptist had been executed by Herod, he withdrew from there in a boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. So Jesus is emotionally weary. He just needs a little time away by himself. But a rumor begins to spread. Hey, I hear that Jesus is nearby. And so people begin flocking out to find Jesus where he is. We're told, verse 14, when Jesus went ashore, he saw a great crowd and he had compassion for them and cured their sick. But as Jesus ministered through the day, and as day began to turn to evening, a big problem developed. How on earth were they going to feed all of these people, this multitude of people, out in the middle of nowhere? You see, they were facing a food crisis. So Jesus said to his disciples, Jesus' disciples said to him, came to him and said to him, Jesus, this is a deserted place and the hour is late. Send the crowds away so that they may go into the villages and buy food for themselves. To which Jesus responded, verse 16, they need not go away. You give them something to eat. The disciples, mortified at what Jesus said, responded, we have nothing here but 5 loaves and 2 fish. The disciples' response to Jesus reminds me of that news story that came out of Australia several years ago. You may have heard it, how a couple pranksters broke into a small town police station at night when it was closed. And just for kicks, they stole the commodes out of the restrooms. So the next morning, you know, the police come in. There are no commodes in the restroom. A local reporter asked the detective on the case, do you have any leads? The detective said, no, we have nothing to go on. Commodes, nothing to go. We need a laugh track for these sermons, I think. I suspect that Jesus' disciples were feeling like that detective. Jesus, we've got nothing to work with here. Just 5 loaves and a couple lousy fish, and what are they when we're looking at a multitude of more than 5,000 people that we're supposed to be feeding? Jesus, in turn, responds to them. Verse 18, he simply says, bring them here to me. Bring me what you've got. Even if it seems small and insignificant, because God can make something great out of it. And herein we see the first key thing that happens in our gospel passage today. Note, please, how radically different Jesus and his disciples were seeing this food crisis. Jesus' disciples looked at the situation and they were focused in on the impossibilities. Meanwhile, Jesus, looking at that very same situation, focused on the possibilities. Jesus' disciples were looking at this situation and focused in on what was instead. Jesus, looking at that same situation, was choosing to focus on what could be. And I use the word choose deliberately because it is a choice. How we choose to frame the situations of our life. This passage of Scripture is just another reminder to each one of us that how we choose to frame the situations of our life makes a huge difference. huge difference. This past Thursday, just a few days ago, I was sitting at my desk working on today's sermon when the doorbell here at the church, the office doorbell, rang. At the time, I was the only one here, so I went to the front door, and as I was walking to the front door, as I was approaching the front door, I could see who was standing at the door, and I'm just going to be honest with you now, and I know this will come as a disappointment to those of you who are convinced that I'm perfect, but I'm not perfect. In fact, I'm terribly imperfect. So I must confess that when I saw who was standing at the door, as I was walking to the door, my first thought was, oh, they must need something now. Because you see, the person that was standing at the door is someone who worshiped with us years ago once or twice. Haven't seen her since. Correction. I've seen her 4 or 5 times since when she needs something. She'll come to the door. She's in crisis. I'll usually give her whatever I've got in my wallet and then won't see her again until she needs something again. And so as I was going to the door, I was thinking, oh, she must be in crisis again. Opened the door, welcomed her in. We went to a classroom to talk. She described the latest crisis, and I came within a hair's breadth of blurting out, I'm going to help you, but it seems like we only see you when you want something. I mean, I was irritated. I came so close. Thankfully, I didn't. I mean, that would have been a really ugly way, a really passive-aggressive way to help somebody, right? So I didn't say that, but I was thinking that. Instead, I said, let me see what I've got in my wallet. And so I left the classroom to go to my office to find my wallet. And when I walked out of the classroom, that's when it hit me. Someone in our congregation, one of you, a little over a month ago, gave 2 bags of non-perishable food items to me and said, you can give these to somebody in need whenever you encounter them. And those 2 bags of groceries have been sitting here at the church for over a month. Last week, as I was in the church kitchen preparing my lunch, I noticed those 2 bags of groceries were still on the counter, and I stopped and I consciously prayed and said, God, you surely gave us those groceries for a reason. You must have a purpose behind them. If you'll bring the right person across my path, I'll gladly give them those groceries. So I'm walking out of this classroom in this annoyed mood, and all of a sudden I remember those bag of groceries. And in that moment, my whole sense of what was happening was suddenly reframed from annoyed to, oh my gosh, I'm in the middle of a wonderful answer to prayer. Weeks ago, God, loving this person that I'm annoyed with perfectly, knew that she was going to need some food and lovingly prompted one of our congregants to bring in a couple bags of groceries that sat there until the need arose. My own spirit prompted me to pray, God, you must have these for someone, a week earlier. And then that someone comes along, and God's answer is right there. And I get the joy of participating in that miracle. Suddenly, everything gets reframed. What is it in your life today that you're needing to reframe? From negative to positive, from despair to hope. Maybe you, like me, are the kind of person who goes around saying, there aren't enough hours in the day. And you get all stressed out about that. What would happen if instead we reframed that through the eyes of faith? And instead we said, there's going to be just enough time. And then we went about doing the most important things. And when the day ended, and instead of carrying the stress of what we didn't get done, we just leave that until tomorrow. Because every time I stop and reframe my thinking from there aren't enough hours in the day to there will be just enough time, there is. And my whole day is much better. Or maybe you find yourself in a midlife or late in life crisis. At a place where you're really coming to grips with your mortality, and you find yourself preoccupied with death and thinking to yourself, when is it going to be? How's it going to be? And what will come after that? What if instead you consciously reframed that through the eyes of faith and allowed yourself to view it as a sacred transition and to envision the angels that are going to ease you through that transition and envision the glories that await you in the life to come? Why on earth would we choose to view death in a morose way when we have the opportunity as people of faith to see it in a completely different framework? Or maybe something happened in your past that was a traumatic experience that has caused you to frame the way you see life or the way you see yourself or feel about yourself in a negative way. And that negative framework is disabling your life or at least holding you back. There's a well-known novel called The Kite Runner. The chief character, the main character, is named Amir. And Amir, at age 12, has a traumatic experience. He happens to stumble on a scene where his best friend Hassan is being raped by a bully, Asef. And in the fear of the moment and being timid, Amir, instead of intervening to try to rescue his friend, ducks down behind a mud wall and pretends he never knew it happened. But in the novel, decades later, Amir realizes that traumatic experience still haunts him day by day and becomes a principal framework through which he's viewing himself and his life. In his own words, Amir puts it this way. He says, "I became what I am today at the age of 12. On a frigid, overcast day in the winter of 1975, I remember the precise moment, crouching behind a crumbling mud wall, peeking into the alley near the frozen creek. That was a long time ago. But it's wrong what they say about the past, about how you can bury it, because the past claws its way out. Looking back now, I realize I've been peeking into that deserted alley for the past 26 years. Maybe there's a traumatic experience in your past that is causing you to frame the way you see life or see yourself in a negative or destructive way. Maybe it's time you consciously worked on reframing that through prayer, through meditation, through journaling, through therapy. Maybe it's time that you consciously sought to reframe that. What we learn from Jesus in our gospel lesson today is that we have to be conscious of the words that we are using to frame the crisis situations in our life. Am I using words of hope or am I using words of despair? Am I being negative or am I being positive? It all begins there. So in the midst of this coronavirus crisis, let me ask you personally, and collectively as a church family, how are we framing this situation? Words of hope or words of despair? Positive or is it all gloom and doom? Are we saying to ourselves we are where we are for a reason, and we will find purpose and opportunity in this moment? We will have a chance in this experience to learn some really important things about ourselves, some critical life lessons, and we will have opportunities in this crisis to help people in need, to serve in beautiful ways. How are we framing it? It all starts there. But it doesn't stop there. Because as we move on through our gospel passage, there's a second key thing that happens. To get from a proper framework for thinking about the food crisis to a beautiful outcome, there was a second thing that had to happen in our gospel story. We've already seen that when Jesus said to the disciples, "You give them something to eat," the disciples responded in verse 17, "We have nothing here but 5 loaves and 2 fish. Have you ever found yourself wondering, where did they get those 5 loaves and 2 fish? John's gospel's account of this same story gives us the answer to that question. John 6:9 says, there, Simon Peter says to Jesus, John 6:9, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many people?" Now think about that. What are the odds that in a crowd of more than 5,000 people, that little boy was the only one who thought to bring food out into the wilderness that day? I've got to believe that there were many, or at least some people, who thought to bring food with them, but they were probably afraid. They were probably hoarding and hiding the food that they had for fear that if others knew they had food, they would ask for some and they would feel pressure to share with the multitude and there might not be enough for them. But not the little boy. With the intuitive innocence and generosity of a child, he took his meager fare and offered it to Jesus to share with the multitude. And it was enough. Jesus took the loaves and the fish. He blessed them, gave them to the disciples, and the disciples started to distribute. And it turns out there was more than enough, so much that there were leftovers. Note, please, that the gospel text does not tell us, none of the gospel accounts of this story tell us how that miracle happened. They just tell us there were 5 loaves and 2 fish, and they distributed them, and they had leftovers. In my mind's eye, I've always imagined that as the basket was passing and someone would take a piece of bread out, that mystically, miraculously, a new piece of bread would appear. And as a fish was removed, a new fish would appear, and maybe that's how it happened, a supernatural miracle. But some theologians have suggested maybe this was a natural miracle. Some theologians have suggested that maybe when the people in the crowd saw the generosity of the little boy and the faith of Jesus, as the basket began to pass, they were so moved, they took out the food that they had and began sharing it as well, so that lo and behold, there was more than enough for everybody. It really doesn't matter to me whether this was, in this instance, a natural or a supernatural miracle. The fact remains it was a miracle. And the most important point is that miracle began with the generosity of one little boy. There's a critical lesson in that for us. It's the power of one. It's the power of one person to act and make a decisive difference. One song can spark a moment. One flower can wake a dream. One tree can start a forest. One bird can herald spring. One smile begins a friendship. One hand clasp lifts a soul. One star can guide a ship at sea. One word can frame a goal. One vote can change a nation. One sunbeam lights a room. One candle wipes out darkness. One laugh will conquer gloom. One step must start each journey. One word starts each prayer. One hope will raise our spirits. One touch can show you care. One life can make a difference, and it can be yours. Do you know how powerful you are? Case in point. Picture a 16-year-old teenage girl whose who has Asperger syndrome, placing her somewhere on the autism spectrum. Not exactly the kind of person that most people would assume would be likely to make a huge difference in this world. This 16-year-old girl, Greta, was angry and decided she was going to cut school. Now, not the first and not the last angry 16-year-old to cut school, but Greta had decided she was going to cut school for a noble reason. And she was so passionate and insistent, as children with Asperger's can be, that her parents relented. She told her parents she wanted to camp out in front of the Swedish Parliament building for the next 30 days. This was the August of 2018. Her parents relented. And so there she was on day one, a cold August day in Stockholm. This solitary 16-year-old girl takes her place in the square in front of the parliament with a homemade sign that read, "School Strike for Climate." On that first day, she was the only one there. But she was posting this on social media. On day two, a stranger joined her. Now there were two. The next day, a handful more joined them. Now there were eight. So one becomes two. Two becomes eight. Eight then became 40. Then there were hundreds. Then there were literally thousands of people gathering outside the Swedish Parliament building on school strike against climate change. And from there, it just took off and became a global phenomenon, so that Greta Thunberg became the de facto leader of a global movement of students and young adults against climate change that spread across the globe, created an incredible sensation, so that in December, just a few months ago, Time magazine named Greta Thunberg its youngest ever person of the year. Time magazine described it this way: over the course of a little more than a year, a 16-year-old from Stockholm went from a solitary protest on the cobblestone outside her country's parliament to leading a worldwide youth movement. From a school kid conjugating verbs in French class to meeting with the Secretary General of the United Nations and receiving audiences with presidents and the Pope. From a solo demonstrator with a hand-painted slogan to inspiring millions of people across more than 150 countries to take to the streets on behalf of the planet we share. That is the power of one person to make a difference. You possess that same power. Every great thing that happens in a family, in a church, in a school, a workplace, in a city, town, state, in a nation, or on this planet, every great thing that happens starts with someone, a solitary person who has reframed a situation from despair to hope, who then steps out and dares to act boldly in a way that is consistent with the reframing of that situation that they have done in their mind's eye. Picture the Dalai Lama as he walks up to a tofu hot dog vendor and says to the vendor, "Make me one with everything." All right, it took a while, but it's cascading out there across the airwaves. People are slowly getting it. So the Dalai Lama walks up to the tofu hot dog vendor and says, "Make me one with everything." So the vendor does. He makes him a tofu hot dog with everything on it, hands it to him. The Dalai Lama hands a $20 bill to the hot dog vendor, who then proceeds to serve the next customer, leaving the Dalai Lama wondering and saying, "Wait a minute, where's my change?" To which the hot dog vendor says, "Ah, change comes from within." Change begins within each one of us when we consciously step back and reframe a crisis situation we're seeing through the eyes of hope rather than the eyes of faith. Step one. Then step two. That reframed vision is given life when we act boldly by faith on that reframed perspective. Which then leaves just one more step to close the circle in our gospel lesson today. One more critical thing that happens in our gospel lesson today. After Jesus said to the disciples, "You give them food to eat." And the disciples said, "What are we going to feed them? We don't have enough. All we've got is 5 barley loaves and a few fish." And Jesus said, "Bring it to me." We're told in verse 19, Matthew 14, 19. Then Jesus ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven. He looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. That's the third and final thing. Jesus looked up to heaven and prayed. He consciously and intentionally invited the power of God into that crisis situation. Yes, it is critically important that we act in faith in a crisis situation, but not without first pausing to consciously invite the power of God into that situation in our lives. So when you are facing a crisis, whether it's coronavirus or a personal crisis that we may be facing in our lives right now, we as disciples of Jesus can consciously seek to replicate the pattern, Jesus' crisis management pattern, in our own lives. It begins when we reframe the crisis using words of hope rather than despair. One. Number two, it continues when we realize the power of one and we act boldly on that reframed perspective, but not without first, number three, consciously inviting the power of heaven into that situation, because there is power in prayer. Let me close with this. In his book, Beyond Jabez, Bruce Wilkinson tells the true story of an African woman who lived in a simple mud hut in extreme poverty, but felt called to take in and care for 56 orphans in Swaziland. You can imagine the challenge of making ends meet. Talk about food scarcity. You can only imagine. One night, this elderly woman was praying for God's help in the situation, God's sufficiency, when she says, "I felt led to pray that God would bring us someone who would help us plant gardens so that we could become self-sufficient." So that's what she prayed. The next morning, she gets up, she says to her 56 children, "Today we're going to go outside and we're going to till the soil. We're going to prepare gardens." The kids say to her, "But why, since we have nothing to plant?" She said to them, "I prayed last night and asked God to send us someone to help us plant the gardens. We must be ready for them." So they went outside, they tilled the soil, and they got everything ready. Later that same day, Bruce Wilkinson says, one of his mission groups that happened to be in Swaziland at that time, who were touring Swaziland with thousands of seedling plants that they were distributing to help people with food sufficiency. That group of people on their missions trip were on the last day of their missions trip and unexpectedly had hundreds of seedlings still left. When they happened to drive past the widow's mud hut and saw all the tilled soil with nothing planted, prompted by the Spirit, curious, they stop. They ask the elderly woman, "Why are all these gardens and nothing planted?" She told them that God had told her to pray for someone to come to help her to plant, and they were getting ready for that. Can you imagine the electricity of that moment when that widow, that elderly widow and her kids and the missions trip volunteers suddenly realize they're in the midst of a great miracle of God? And of course, they pitch in, and that day they planted all the seedlings. And now, there was more than enough. And there it is. In one little story, the replication of the exact same pattern we see in our gospel story today. That widow reframed the situation through the eyes of hope. She and her kids dared to act, but not before first inviting the power of heaven into their situation. One elderly African woman, a faithful disciple, replicating Jesus' crisis management pattern in her own life to great effect. What about us? In this coronavirus crisis, how are you framing it? With whatever personal crisis you may face in your life right now, how are you framing it? Let the reframing begin. Amen.